From the prize-winning blogger of WaiterRant.net comes the book Waiter Rant. It's an insider's hilarious look at a waiter's life in an upscale New York area restaurant. Nick Schinkel, director of the West Lafayette Public Library, has a review and begins by reading from Waiter Rant.
I'm a waiter. I bring food to tables in exchange for tips. At first glance, it seems like a simple job. Just be neat, polite, display some salesmanship, and don't forget to smile. Easy, right? What world are you living in? Today, waiters are expected to be food allergy specialists, sommeliers, cell phone rule enforcers, eye candy, confessors, entertainers, mixologists, emergency medical technicians, bouncers, receptionists, joke tellers, therapists, linguists, punching bag psychics, protocol specialists, and amateur chefs. Foodie porn TV programming has generated a new class of entitled customers with already overblown culinary expectations and a rapidly diminishing set of social graces. Economists say that the restaurant business is a bellwether of the nation's economic health, but I think it's a bellwether of America's mental health as well. And let me tell you, 20% of the American dining public are socially maladjusted psychopaths. We should start putting Prozac in the Perrier. Well, yes, hot on the heels of Julie and Julia and Anthony Bourdain's Kitchen Confidential, to name just two books, and indeed, I guess, a movie there, we now have a fresh, if cynical, look at the world of lower-income service jobs, Waiter Rant. If you have ever worked in a service job, join in. If you've ever been served in a sit-down restaurant, listen up. Well, what's it all about, you might ask, as if you couldn't tell from that introduction. Let's let our author, who remains anonymous throughout the book, tell us what his book is all about, as he writes. For the last 4 years, I've been anonymously chronicling my restaurant exploits at a website called Waiter Rant. From my server station at a white tablecloth restaurant called The Bistro, I've written about the joys and pains of working in the food service industry. Staying anonymous has let me freely chronicle my chronicle's bad behavior without fear of retribution and bad tips. But it's also allowed me to talk about people behaving beautifully, too. I've been fortunate that my writing has attracted millions of readers, won a few awards, and grabbed a little bit of that crazy stuff called quasi-fame. Despite all the attention I've received, very few people know who I am or where the bistro is located. After 3 years, I was confronted by a customer only once. I'll go on to tell you that once his book came out earlier this year, he made the typical book press kind of tours. And so, of course, his name came out and then where he worked came out. So you can find all that if you would like to on the internet, strangely enough. But the book stands on its own, well worth reading. Here's why. Here's more. Waiter Rant reads as much as a contemporary confessional novel as the nonfiction rant of a 30-something waiter it claims to be. And this storytelling is what raises Waiter Rant from a mere collection of blog posts, which can be interesting in themselves, to an engaging, page-turning read. The author's skills are well-honed, not only for serving us our dinner, but for writing as well. And not surprising, he's been writing a waiter blog, as he told us, for years after all. And those skills are on display often. Listen to this well-turned description of his upscale daily workplace and the folks on whom he waits. And he actually is telling two stories in this particular chapter. I'm going to focus in on one of those stories. I think you'll find out why. I'm not paying attention to what I'm doing with the table I'm at. I don't have to. I've done it 20,000 times. It's all muscle memory by now. Instead, I'm listening to the young couple at the table behind me. They're talking about having a baby. I'm listening to the couple behind me. The girl's afraid to have children. She's afraid she'll abandon them like her mother abandoned her. Her husband tells her not to worry. She's not her mother. She's a different person. She'll be a wonderful mother. They'll be happy. Meanwhile, my Four Tops host, the folks I'm serving right now, thanks me. His wife compliments my memory. How can you remember so much stuff? I respond with a witty stock answer. They all laugh. I tell them I'll give them time to consider their choices. I turn and look at the table behind me. The girl has tears in her eyes. The boy is holding her hand. For the thousandth time, I marvel how much people reveal about themselves inside a restaurant. I shouldn't be surprised. When people are stuffing their faces, they often let their guard down. Eating is a primal activity that triggers an array of emotional responses. Think of all the arguments that erupt around family dinner tables. Food and the human condition are inextricably linked. Because of this, waiters often get to see the unpleasant sides of people. Yet amid all the petulance, anger, and entitlement, the occasional crumb of human grace falls from the table. I look at the boy and girl. They need their privacy. This is an important moment. Do not disturb. I walk away. Well, our nameless author pulls us into his tale from the start, relating to us his disaffection, first with his efforts to become a priest by taking college at a seminary, where he came to grow cynical about the ways of the contemporary church. Leaving a path to the ministry, he next offers us his erstwhile attempt to offer ethical, caring care to the mentally challenged, a series of jobs which left him still in his 20s and fed up with the duplicity of our contemporary healthcare system. And then, our protagonist, down on his luck, willing to take just about any temporary employment as a way to make money until he finds his place in the world, we get to the core of this tale, our author's fiery plunge into the world of waiting tables and the world of New York City's fine dining environment, an experience that he relates, as we've learned, with humor and not a little sarcasm. Listen to this riff on the undying enmity between waitstaff and kitchen staff, which, our author claims, is at the center of every fine restaurant or diner at which we unwittingly eat. If a waiter wants respect from the back of the house, he or she has to show respect in return. And the best way to do that is to understand the kitchen staff and waiters are like the Palestinians and the Israelis, separate and distinct nationalities, uncomfortably sharing the same volatile piece of real estate. A big difference between waiters and cooks is the hours they work. Waiters usually work an 8 or 9 hour shift and go home. The kitchen guys, however, are often the first to show up and the last to go home. 14-hour days are common. When a restaurant closes its doors for the night, you'll probably find half its servers getting blasted at a nearby bar, but you'll find the kitchen guys sharing a taxi or waiting at a bus stop for a public transportation ride home. Because most fine dining establishments are located in neighborhoods where residential rents are high, kitchen personnel seldom can afford to live close to their place of employment. That means they often have a very long commute to and from work. One of our prep cooks buses it from Queens every day. Depending on traffic, that can be a 3-hour round trip, 6 days a week, on top of working a 14-hour shift. The waiters have cars and shorter commutes. They have free time. This disparity in leisure hours often leads to resentment between the front and back of the house. At the end of the night, the exhausted kitchen guys just want to go home and enjoy what little free time they have left. Well, our author goes on to become the manager of a newly opened fine dining establishment in a nearby upscale town. He labels it the Bistro in his blog and in this book. And he finds that managing a restaurant is more daring and challenging than he at first thought when he was, quote-unquote, only a waiter. As we read on, then, we're offered his thoughts on any number of dining topics. Some of the most cutting and hilarious revolve around the less-than-stellar impact on American dining life caused by the success of the Food Channel and its 24-hour, 7-day-a-week superstars, and the resulting development in the American dining world of a type of diner our author labels foodies. Don't get me wrong, in the long run, an educated customer's a good thing. I'm happy to see palates becoming more informed and adventurous. High school kids eat sashimi, college kids churn their own tofu, and adults daydream about opening vineyards in Napa. We have 12-grain bread, frozen Thai food, $24 mustards, gourmet chocolates, and more places to eat out than ever before. Restaurants, food, and kitchen equipment are a multi-billion-dollar industry, and every industry needs a PR network. Today, the most visible propaganda arm of that industry is the Food Network. The Food Network is, quite simply, the Death Star of American cooking. Born in the crucible of cable television, it gradually assumed the level of influence that once belonged to Julia Child and the James Beard Society. There's nothing wrong with learning about food, and there's nothing wrong with learning how to cook. In that regard, I think the Food Network's a cool thing. You just have to remember those telegenic chefs massaging olive oil into rump roasts are also trying to move cheap aluminum cookware with their name on it out of a warehouse in southern China. I worry food is being sexualized into a sort of status symbol in the service of profit. What happens when these messengers are constantly inculcated into people's psyches? I'm not saying they're doing anything deliberate, but after watching the Food Network's on-air personalities wax orgasmically in reverent tones about grilled this and sautéed that, the pickings in my average cupboard start looking shabby in comparison. I know, food's been a status symbol ever since the lords of the feudal manor ate meat while the peasants ended up with offal and hooves. Fast forward 1,000 years. Today we drool over elaborately filmed platters on television the way chubby teenage girls look at the skinny fashion models. People think TV life is real life. Everyone wants to be a rock star. People want to eat like a rock star. We're starting to become convinced that everything that passes our lips has to be sexy, fresh, wonderful, and exciting. A peanut butter and jelly sandwich doesn't cut it anymore. Well, after going through all these wonderful dining experiences that he gets to see as our waiter and we don't get to see happening back in the back room, he ends with two appendices. Appendix A, 40 tips on how to be a good customer, and Appendix B, 50 ways to tell you're working in a bad restaurant. I'll let you consider what might be in those 50 ways to tell you you're working in a bad restaurant. It's good of him to include them because we can all get a clue as to what's going on that way. But let's read just a couple of these 40 tips on how to be a good customer to give you a sense of how he wants to end his tale of fine dining. Number one, the number one tip, make reservations and keep them. Number two, if you're going to be late for your reservation, please call. We'll hold your table. After half an hour, you might not get the special table you requested, but you'll still get in. An hour late? On a busy night? Turn around and go home. Don't even bother. Number 10. Do not use your cell phone in the restaurant. Yes, you, the always need to be connected BlackBerry junkie. Didn't anyone tell you it's rude to talk to a cell phone or text a message while other people are eating? Unless you're a heart transplant surgeon on standby, turn it off or put it on vibrate. Number 40 in the 40 tips on how to be a good customer. If you can't afford to leave a tip, you can't afford to eat in the restaurant, stay home. All this said, let me give you a fair warning, if you haven't caught on already. Waiter rant is not for the faint of heart. The language can at times be salty. The subjects at times are more adult than family. And this former seminarian proves his cynicism with his sometimes caustic view of humanity. Remember that opening line where he said that 80% of us may just be wonderful people as diners, but the other 20% really we need to worry about. For all its 21st century sarcasm, Waiter Rant is, as one critic wrote, quote, never overbearing and certainly never self-righteous, end quote. One critic of the book even compares it favorably to the runaway hit TV show The Office, writing that, quote, parts of the book were just flat out funny. In that kind of way, The Office is funny to those who work in the corporate world, end quote. And as is becoming usual, if you're intrigued by my review of Waiter Rant, I invite you to launch yourself into the reviews found at the major internet book sites. Some of these folks are writing their own books. As they review this one, there's some blog potentials out there. Waiter Rant is that inspiring to some readers. They just want to write on and on and on and on about it. And maybe After you read it, you'll feel that way too. It's a fun read, and it's an educational as well as entertaining read. Aren't a whole lot of those out there. I think you'll enjoy it. Waiter Rant. Thanks for the tip. Confessions of a Cynical Waiter by The Waiter. It's available at many of our fine libraries and certainly at the West Lafayette Public Library.
Nick Schinkel is the director of the West Lafayette Public Library, and he's reviewed Waiter Rant by The Waiter.